Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You think about the person in your life when you started believing you more than anyone else. They're the ones that make the sacrifices. When I walk out, my old man's next to me. They're not just looking at you, they're looking at what made you. Now, I want them talking about our fucking game. I want them talking about us. All right, enjoy your lunch.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Hello, Windy.
And our tactics guy, and a man who's just come out of surgery, actually. He's been donating his hamstrings to Mickey van der Ven. It's Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
I don't need them.
Yeah, exactly. And he certainly does, poor chap. The amount of runs back towards his own goal he has to do. How's it going, guys?
Not too bad. I was laughing. Was it his hamstring that went? I thought it looked more knee than hamstring this time.
Oh, okay. I assumed hamstring because it's always a hamstring with him. But yeah, maybe you could be right. He looked in a lot of pain, but the suggestion from Ange post-match was that he doesn't think it's a big deal.
Okay.
Fingers crossed
on that.
Yeah.
But what does it matter? We're now entering the year of the dragon, so we don't need van der Ven anymore.
Mm.
Solid first proper appearance for Dragušin, I think. Before we get stuck in on the discussion last week about two-footedness in players, Daryl Hawkins said, lads, there's only one answer, Davy Ginola. He was actually two-footed with no perceptible difference on either side. As a child, he broke his foot and had to practice for a long spell, kicking only with his weaker foot. And yeah, you could certainly tell that. And the thing with Ginola was the dribbling ability. He could go genuinely either way, and defenders were constantly kept guessing by his ability to go inside or out. And yeah, what a fantastic player to watch he was. So people, yeah, thank you, Daryl, for that.
The youngsters these days don't realise that how much of a torch of hope Davy Ginola was, because it was really bad. I mean, we always go on, oh, old man going on about the 90s again, but it was really bad. But Davy Ginola gave us something to hope for and something to cling on to. Perhaps he would never work in like modern day football, but back then he was a god because he was just a break from the norm.
100%. So we've got a lovely 4-0 routine victory to talk about. It's going to be delightful tucking into this one. We'll start with the starting 11 as usual. For this one, there were actually three changes. Porro, Saar and Johnson came in for Emerson, Bentancourt and Werner, who supposedly had a bit of a knock and wasn't able to start. Nathan, what was your reaction to the team news?
I liked it. I liked that, obviously. We've been talking about maybe experimenting with Kulusevski not in the first 11, but Werner having a knock sort of simplifies things there a little bit, allows him to become an impact sub. Obviously, Porro, significant. And right now, Saar, a significant upgrade on Bentancourt, in my opinion, too.
Yeah, I would agree with that at the moment, for sure. Bardi, we should talk about Johnson, because there was a lot of appreciation for Brennan Johnson post-match. Deli Mundo says, I was really buoyed by Brennan Johnson's performance. He seemed able to beat his man in 1v1 situations. With coaching, can he become good enough of a dribbler to meet the high standards that Nathan would like to set? And Ivan Victor adds, and the Oscar for best dribbly winger goes to Brennan Johnson.
I've been kind of up on Brennan Johnson since we signed him. I've liked his output, and even though I've been perhaps critical in his overall game and what he offers to us, his output has been great. But I thought from the first moment he was on a different level this week. I thought he gave Matty Cash a real hard time. He did put together some nice dribbles. He used the ball wisely, and I thought he was a threat throughout. He got a bit tired maybe in the second half, but scored a good goal, and I thought he was excellent, and I'm really happy. I wanted to see him start. I perhaps would have dropped Kulusevski for Werner. I didn't realise Werner was on the bench because of a knock. Those are the two. I would have started Werner and Johnson. But I'm very happy with Johnson. And in the end, I thought Kulusevski really grew into the game and was very influential at the end.
Absolutely. Yeah. Really interesting match for our wingers generally, I thought. So, Nathan, we should probably talk about the team shape because it was an interesting one. Obviously, a change around from the Palace game last week when they played in a back four. Villa defended in a back five, mm-hmm. which I thought was interesting. They deliberately adjusted their system to accommodate playing against Spurs. And that meant that we pressed in a different shape and we had Maddison just behind a front three in our pressing structure. Maddison stuck very close to Douglas Luiz. And when I was watching back, I found it really interesting that for quite a large chunk of the certainly time he was on the pitch, it almost made it seem like Saar was playing in a double pivot with Bissouma. But actually, it was simply that they had their guys that they were focusing on. And Saar had Tielemans, Maddison had Douglas Luiz, and Bissouma had McGinn primarily in the pressing structure. So it was simply that Maddison was a little bit further forward because he was sitting on Douglas Luiz and trying to make it difficult for him to dictate play.
Yes, but I think there's some deliberance in that because we had Bissouma play quite aggressively on Luiz.
We did.
Which meant that like in a defensive transition situation, Bissouma's pushing up forward momentum, picking up Luiz, cutting off the space behind Bissouma, and Saar is sprinting backwards and covering space in behind. We've talked quite a lot about how difficult that number six role is in and out of possession, how mentally and physically exhausting must be, how much space they're responsible for. And I think the situation where we make use of Saar's legs and have him covering ground backwards with momentum that is heading in the direction of the opposition's play, I think that's a really nice little tweak. Helps us cover the space there a lot better, take some of the pressure off Bissouma a little bit, and allows his defensive aggression to be better utilized with forward momentum as well. So I quite like that. Yeah.
No surprise then that Bissouma had his best match in goodness knows how long. Well, I thought so. Sure. I don't know if you guys agreed. I thought he was really strong without the ball, but with the ball, just so much assuredness. There was one incident where he gave the ball away with a poor sideways pass and then quickly tried to recover. But aside from that tiny scare, I thought Bissouma had a really, really fantastic match. And I think I haven't checked the numbers, but I assume that he had the most touches in our team. It felt like he did.
Him or Romero.
He was a ball magnet in this game.
I'm curious now. Bissouma 108, Romero 101.
Yeah. I mean, I think that makes sense to me. Absolutely. Saar really supported Bissouma in this game really effectively. And whilst he didn't have much of the ball, Saar, his off-ball movement was fantastic. And obviously, we managed to exploit that for the opening goal. Saar making a burst forward in the inside right channel and picking across a fantastic...
What a cross.
First time cross.
What a cross. Perfect. Perfect.
Do you want to say any more about that?
The context of my praise, not that it wasn't obvious to everyone who watched, was just like I was thinking about like doing a breakdown of some of our full pitch plays in this game, and I wanted to sort of like the anatomy of every pass, every bit of the play that leads up to that. And it's like, okay, there's this clever movement here where Poro loses his man, and there's a good bit of play here where Kulusevski shields the ball well, and there's the late movement here from Saar and dragging the defender, all that kind of stuff, dragging a defender by Sun. Why does the final ball work? Just because the delivery is excellent. Maddison doesn't get himself free from his man. He just trusts the pass, and the pass is perfect.
Yeah, and I want to give a little shout out to Maddison as well for that finish. Oh, yeah. Because it comes at a really awkward height. Like, it's almost diving header height.
Yeah.
It's almost like you either go with the stooping header or you risk whether you can get your leg up quite high enough to angle it in. And he made it look so easy. Like, so calm, composed. And this isn't Maddison on top form either. Maddison is still kind of fighting his way back to getting somewhere back to his best. And yeah, like, took that beautifully, I thought.
There was a moment on the goal where Saar was sprinting and he lost balance and it looked like he was going to go down, but he managed to like regain his balance and then whip it in. It was a beautiful ball, like Beckham, Trent Alexander-Arnold, all those best right wingers, that they would have been proud of that ball. And there's something beautiful. I know I go on about certain individuals in our team that I just don't feel them. I don't feel the way they play, how they look and how they move. But with Sarr, I've just had this obsession with Sarr since we signed him. I love how he just motors around the pitch. I love his legginess and his athleticism. And I think he's doing all of that, but now he's adding technical stuff to it as well. He scored a goal from distance. He's got an assist. I think he just gives us a whole different dimension. Bentancur's a brilliant player as well, but he just doesn't have the legs that Sarr has.
So whilst we're talking Sarr, this question came in from one of our ex-subs, Dan Alvarez. Just so you know, we always prioritise questions from our ex-subs. So it's one way of getting your voice heard on the Extra Inch. Dan says, have we as Spurs fans made it enough of what Sarr has done this season? In about 1,500 minutes, he's put up similar numbers to some of the elite peak age midfielders in Europe. Look at his numbers in comparison to Fede Valverde or Rodri, for instance, at 21. He may not be our best midfielder, but he's had an absurd season and has been one of the best young midfielders in the world. He's doing absolutely everything and it's been a joy to watch. And Stone Valley King takes it a step further and says, is Sarr our player of the year?
I mean, we do like to get carried away. I'm not sure if he's our player of the year yet. But at 21 years old, he's an incredible prospect who's got still room to improve as well. But it's really exciting to have him. I wouldn't put him yet with Valverde or Rodri, no matter what the numbers say. But he could definitely get there for sure.
Winnie, let's address our powerful anti-Sarr agendas that we both harbour. You and I have both expressed concerns previously about the way that he telegraphs his pass sometimes. And not just that, the way he telegraphs how he's going to receive the ball as well, how he can receive the ball with quite a closed body, how he often takes a touch towards the player that he's going to pass it to with, here comes the pass, everyone. Those things are still present in his play. They've decreased, I would say. I think that he's improving in those areas. But I also think that, it just isn't as negative a factor as it feels like it should be, right? Which is not to say that there's never been a case where he's telegraphed a pass, the opposition have intercepted it, and we've conceded a counterattack, because that has happened a couple of times, not for a little while now, maybe. But I think that, sometimes the way he does things is definitely not by the book. Sometimes the way he does things is not aesthetically pleasing. We're going to be talking about Dragusin later. But, it works. what he's doing is working. Mm. Sometimes he receives the ball awkwardly and he has to do, a 270-degree turn with the ball to get it out from under his feet. And I'm like, oh, no, that's really bad. But, then the opposition don't try to challenge him in that moment, and it's fine. And he just has a way of commanding space, of gliding about the pitch, of finding a way to take the time, to have the time that he needs to have those kinds of touches, which again are not by the book, are technically imperfect or critiquable. In the end, what he's achieving on the pitch is outstanding, especially for his age. So I want to walk back a little bit, some of the technical criticism I've had of him. I think, not to say that I imagined it, not to say that it's never again led to a turnover, just that not everyone has to be the exact same player to make things work for them, right?
I think you've absolutely nailed it, Nathan. I think, I think some of my criticisms were slightly different to yours, but rooted in some of the similar stuff. It's like the
bobbling pass don't like.
Yeah, so he has this habit of when he plays a side foot pass over short distances, he'll hit the bottom of the ball, or he'll hit strike down on the bottom of the ball, and it kind of makes the ball bounce and bobble, and so it's harder for the teammate to receive the ball. And when I say harder, I'm talking
percentage
fractions
points.
Here. Yeah.
And we're talking
about stuff that makes a difference.
Players who are meant to be elite at receiving the ball anyway, right?
Yeah, and I remember you did a video about Christian Eriksen once, and the thing you were saying about Eriksen was he does so many things that every other midfielder does. He makes passes that every other midfielder makes, but the reason he's so brilliant is because he makes those passes in a way that makes it very easy for the receiving player. He takes so much care in the passes. Yep. And so that's kind of where my criticism of Sarr's passing was coming from. And I still believe that that's a thing. I still notice them, because once you've noticed them once, you can't stop noticing them. It's annoying. I don't want to notice it, but I do.
Yeah.
But he more than makes up for it in other ways. Yeah. And the abilities he offers on the pitch are abilities that don't exist in other areas of our squad currently. Now, I think Bentancur is, at his physical peak, our best presser in the whole team. But Bentancur is so far off his physical peak right now, to an extent where I don't even want him starting matches, that Saar has become vital, I would say. Like, we need Saar to make the system work at the moment because we don't have any other midfielders that can do what he does. Skip, not even close. Højbjerg, forget about it. Bentancur in this current state, no. He can't, he's not up to the tracking back, the running back, the like the gliding, as you say. He can't cover the ground in the same way that Saar does. So yes, he doesn't have many touches as often in games, but he's doing stuff off the ball that's really important and vital. And like, I think, like, I've challenged Bardi on his distaste for Højbjerg on the basis that you have to look at the output and not the way it appears. Yeah. And so I need to be consistent and accept that I need to look at Saar's output and not the way it appears. And as soon as I've started doing that, I've started appreciating him a whole lot more. Yeah. And he's also a really lovely boy. He seems so sweet, and the other players adore him. I was really delighted by the fact that Maddison ran straight over to him and like was giving him the credit for that goal, because he deserved the credit because he'd made the goal happen, like you say.
Did you, sorry, buddy. Just one final thing, because you brought up Maddison for that goal. He wanted to go and praise Saar, but he also wanted to wind up the Villa fans, and he was like caught in between the two.
100%. Yeah. And Johnson was the same. Johnson did a bit of shushing after his goal, which I enjoyed.
Why does Johnson have beef with Villa fans? Are Forest and Villa, are they rivals? Are they? Or just Villa?
Midlands, isn't it?
No, Midlands, isn't it? I think with Saar, Windy, because I know you now, you've revealed I might not be your best friend, but I know what you're like. I just think for you, he's not touchy enough. You like your midfielders and even your fullbacks. You like your touch. And he's not that type of player. Højbjerg gets the ball and just touches it backwards all the time. And you like that. I don't. I like my midfielders to have a bit of oomph about them. And that's what Saar has. He's got the players next to him who can do the tippy-tappy. Saar's out there getting it done, which I quite admire.
I do really, that's basically right. I do like a midfielder that feels the ball a lot. I like a midfielder that has the ball at his feet a lot. And that's not Saar, and I don't think it ever will be. Like, I don't think he could ever play the six. People will say all the time, oh, you know, we should try Saar at the six. He's not a six. He's never going to be a six. What, like, the idea that you'd even suggest that in this system is baffling to me. But, like, I need to, and we all need to appreciate him for what he is and not what he isn't. And that is a really... technically and athletically gifted number eight in the specific role that Ange has given him, and it's working out really, really well for him. And I'm obviously delighted that we've got a bargainous find of a midfielder. And he's got the most delightful smile. He seems like such a nice young man. Long may it continue.
Oh, and good luck to his future career in computer science, by the way.
What's that about?
I saw some quotes recently that he's interested in pursuing computer science after football at some point in his career. That's an interest
but
of his.
The coming deep might come in time, man. He's still a young kid who's still learning his game. And at the moment, it's like, what can he do really well right now? And right now, it's using space, using his athleticism, his understanding of when to move and where to move. He's using that right now. And as he matures and improves technically and everything else, and he sees the pitch better, maybe then he'll start moving backwards. And perhaps, like, look at the age difference between him and Bissouma. There's like 6-7 years. That's a long time in a footballer's career. So I don't know what Bissouma was like at 21. Maybe he was the same kind of rambunctious centre midfielder that got around the place. And then as he matured, he developed. So that might still be to come with Saar.
So there's so many other players we need to talk about in this game. There's a lot going on. We'll talk a little bit about the second goal. I think the anticipation was excellent. I thought Son had delayed the pass too long at first, but he didn't. And I thought Johnson tucked it away magnificently.
Yeah, I nice pressing trap, excellent turnover from Kulusevski, who you a moment ago, Windy, said that you think Bentancur is the best presser in our team. I think Kulusevski gives him a run for his money on that front. And exampled here, winning the ball. Pretty selfless game from Sun, I would say, overall. He laid on a good few chances and looked for the pass and has done recently, been looking for the pass as the number nine, which is interesting. When I first watched that goal, I thought, oh, he's put the pass a little behind Johnson there, and Johnson's had to dig it out. But then I can't remember who, a discussion in my Twitter mentions about him prioritizing putting it onto Johnson's right foot rather than forcing it out to Johnson's left, because that's not a good position for him, shooting from the left. So I think, better to prioritize Johnson's right foot there than allowing his momentum.
Just on Kulusevski, Bud, you had some issues with him in the first half, which we should probably talk about. I thought he had a monster of a second half. I remember in the home game, he had a strong performance, home game against Villa, that is. And I thought in the second half, they couldn't cope with him, basically, with what he was doing, which was physically, they couldn't cope with him holding them off and protecting the ball. And then when he pressed or when he carried the ball forward, they were kind of scared of him and they were standing off him. And he just made things happen, you know, through balls, crosses, just really, really, really impressive. And if there was any doubt that he might be losing his place, it was kind of like he'd heard last week's pod and was like, not having that one, lads.
Yeah, he did have a slow first half, but the second half, he was influential in the goal. It was his touch that won the turnover. But I do think that was a team press, because one individual can run as much as they want and press as much as they want. If there's not, it's the delay. It's the bad pass into McGinn that gives Kulusevski the moment to do it. I just felt in the first half, with us getting the ball in some good positions, but nothing really working, I was admiring how Johnson was trying something and trying to make something happen. Whereas Kulusevski, I just felt once again, was slowing it down and was becoming a bit predictable. But that totally changed in the second half, and he had a great 45 minutes. I do think Villa played into our hands here. Now, I don't watch a lot of Villa, but I found this setup very strange. And then playing a back five with like all the centre backs in the world on the pitch at once, I found bizarre. So I would like to hear what you guys thought about that.
Talk me through, sorry, your wording on that question, please, Bardi.
So like Aston Villa, they normally play a back four, and they changed to a back five for us.
Yeah, I mean, so they often shape up in a 4-4-2 in possession, but they do frequently use, for example, Konsa at right back. They did seem to want to come into the season playing three centre backs a lot of the time. We saw Pau Torres moving into left back a lot in this game, so they do like to blur the lines between a 3 and a 4 and have done all season. Because like I tweeted before the game, oh, it will probably be Konsa at right back. But then I thought, no, they'll probably frequently change it up throughout the game. As it happens, they've lent super hard into the back five out of possession and mixed it up more 4-4-2 in possession. Anyway, this is something they do on season, just to establish that. Specifically, we're going to see this a lot more often. Teams setting up against us with the back five, specifically a 5-3-2, because that mirrors us, inverted mirrors us, you know what I mean? And also specifically a narrow back five, although that was less true in this game. I tweeted about this, but this is a continuation of this very recurring pattern. First half, a team sets up in a back five, they drop deeper than they usually do, especially for Villa's case, because we know they love their high line, but they dropped off, and they just look to prevent football from happening in the first 45 minutes. So we go in 0-0, and then like in this game, like against Brentford, like against who else was it recently, Palace, they come out and they try to press us in the second half, and the moment they start to do that, they get themselves into real trouble. That's where we're getting all these goals in bunches. I think that like we're good. I think that we are putting the opposition in a real predicament. are you going to spend 90, you know, plus 10 minutes trying to defend your Boxall game? It worked for Wolves. It's not like it can't happen. Or are you going to have some pride, right? Are you going to get tired of doing that, mentally, physically tired of doing that? Are you going to try and have some of the ball yourself in the second half? Are you going to save some of your energy for the second half because then you think you can get at us? If you try and you're not, you know, Man City, maybe Brighton, if we've got our first choice players in our back line, that's a real risky thing to do. It's also risky to only come away from the game with 20% possession. We're creating that predicament for teams again and again and again. Again, it worked for Wolves. You can low block and counter us all game. It might go your way. It might not, you know? Villa come out pressing. Second half, we put two goals in the back of the net. Then I don't mind this at all. We take a little break. We take it easy. Villa are in this difficult position of, well, we just tried to force our way into the game and that cost us two goals. But now we're two goals down. We even more need to find a way into this game. It's a really tricky place to be for them, right? Maybe that's a significant factor in leading to McGinn's red card, right? They want to up the intensity without upping the risk. So you get an error, you know? And obviously, in this case, it's as much an emotional error as it is a tactical run, because McGinn runs in there way off the ball with the deliberate intention to hurt and punish Udogi for dribbling past his teammates, right? And that's why it's a red card. You don't always see those given as red cards. I think they probably should be. And I will stand by that decision when Romero does it at some point, right? So then again, yeah, you've got this period where we take a bit of a break. We catch our breath for 10, 15 minutes. Then we bring on our subs and then we go at them again. By that point, like, Villa have accepted the pace of the game. They're just trying to see the game out. And then we raise the tempo again and that catches them off guard, which is probably what they tried to do to us at halftime, right? Go on.
Yeah, I do think this was one of the best examples of Ange's Tottenham. I think this game was a complete... We arrived at Villa against a team that's in fourth place in the league on merit, man. It's not like they fluked their way there. We arrived there and we just took their philosophy and just forced them to change it because they knew they couldn't cope with it. So mentally, they'd built this game up, but they'd already lost because they completely abandoned their morals to try and counter us. And then we still beat them. We still went 2-0 up. And then they tried to change and they got frustrated. They kicked out. And then we just buried them. I would like it to have been 5 or 6 just to really teach them a lesson. But it was a great performance. And it really is heartwarming that there can be something. Because it's been a bit bad for a few weeks. And I think we've glossed over it. But that was really nice performance.
Yeah, I think it has been bad for the past few weeks. And I've kept sort of resolute in my analysis that I think it's due to players being short of fitness or not having the right players available at the right time. For me, in this game, we saw Udogi back to his best, probably his best game since fairly early season, to be honest. Bissouma back to his best after his time away in January and via suspension. Porro back in the team makes a huge difference. Just the assuredness, the calmness, the precision of his passing, the touch in midfield, his one-on-one defending, like, elevated us significantly. And I think probably the difference in this game is the sucker punches were made to count. Like, we actually hit the back of a net. We made the final pass well. Ange will be delighted because 3 of the goals came from crosses and the other came from counter-pressing. I mean, that is peak Ange ball. He'll be absolutely thrilled with that. And just to go back briefly to Villa's system, the reason I think they played like they did with the back five, partly I think because it's probably the first time that both Konsa and Pau Torres have been fit for quite a while. Okay. And Longley has kind of made his way into the team and looks like he's staying there now. But also I think they wanted to play both Bailey and Watkins, probably up against our two centre-backs, 2v2, and have Tiedemans there to try and put them in. And I want to give a shout out to our centre backs, because aside from a couple of scary moments, all three of them I thought did a really good job in terms of their reading of the game, their screening of the ball coming through to the player they were up against, and then the sort of physical handling of Bailey and Watkins, who are tricky customers to play against and both in extremely good form as well. Who wants to start on Dragušin?
I'll let Nathan go first on Radu.
Yeah. It's kind of like the SAR discussion, right? It doesn't look pretty. It looks awkward. Some of the body mechanisms of it, where it's like, I'm going to shift the ball onto my right foot now, explosively for no reason. It looks awkward, but like it was fine. It worked. And obviously, like, comes into a situation where fairly soon the opposition are down to 10 men. And before that, they weren't doing a great job of putting pressure on him. So he's got time on the ball. But then I always think in that situation, okay, let's see if you can make use of the time that you have on the ball and play adventurous passes. And he played a couple. He played a really nice ball into Saar that Van de Ven doesn't look to make ever, really. Yeah. That's true. And also, when he made his simple sideways pass to Romero, he kept putting it just a yard behind where I want him to put it. Just not quite on Romero's right foot, but instead underneath Romero's torso. You know what I mean? And it's these kind of imperfections that we were talking about earlier with Saar, where it's like, okay, what's the phrase here? I'm being overly critical, right? But these are like the fine margins that matter in the most elite level of football. Defensively, I was happy with him. I know people were a little critical what was it? There was a moment that people weren't happy with.
He did give the ball away on the left.
That's in position. I wanted to come deep to that. But there was a one where he was chasing the ball in behind. I thought I was happy with what I saw defensively, and his physical tools were very present in those moments, right? So yeah, in possession, there's one moment where he lost the ball, and again, to be overly critical again, it's true that Vigario launches the ball into him, and that is a horrible position for a centre back to be in. It's also true that if he did that to Van de Ven, it probably would have been fine. And these are the fine margins where it matters. The way that we play with two centre backs, and good luck with that, lads, you're on your own, right? You've got to solve some problems there, right? And Van de Ven and Romero are special talents who can take advantage of that and make that work for us as a team by underloading that area. That's a hard, hard ask, what we're asking of our third centre back, but it's a question that we do have to pose them.
Yeah, he's a real meat hammer of a defender. He's not pretty to look at, but no. I think we let Van de Ven off the hook as well, because he isn't the prettiest in possession either. It's just he just gallops. He knocks the ball and gallops after it. So I think that's okay as long as he's got Romero next to him. And I thought Romero was brilliant yesterday. I thought he was quietly, but maybe one of our man of the match. And he looks good at that beard. He looks much better with a beard than he does clean shaven. So I think he should keep that. But it was definitely something in Dragusin which I was nervous about him, but he played well. And I'm not too bothered about he's not spraying the ball about like Romero, because like you said, Van de Ven doesn't do it either. For me, I just want him to be good on the turn. Play the easy ball into Bissouma, Romero, Maddison. That's what those guys are there for. And just don't do any rickets. And I'm fairly happy with him. And I wouldn't mind him seeing him start against Fulham if Van de Ven's not fully fit. I would prefer to rest Van de Ven instead of rushing him back.
Yeah, I think I agree with that as well. The other thing that was glorious about this match was McGinn getting a straight red, which we'll see him miss three matches. The three matches that he will miss for Villa, who, you know, are narrowly above us at the moment, but hopefully by the time Saturday comes, we'll be back behind us, are West Ham away, Wolves, so local derby at home, and Man City away. So absolutely ideal for them to be without their captain for those three, right? Brilliant. I thoroughly enjoyed seeing McGinn get his marching orders for just the most obnoxiously aggressive, frustrated challenge. I understand footballers get frustrated, but like deliberately lashing out and kicking an opposition player like that, like it's just so... And Ndoki's such a quiet, unassuming boy as well, and a young player. Like, it's completely out of order and absolutely nailed on red from my perspective. I cannot understand the complaints about it. Hilarious that they were just singing his song at the time the referee brandished the red card. Just all round perfection. Do you want to do your question,
Sorry,
buddy?
Just on that, Kamara is still out injured for a little bit, I think. So they're going to have to play a Tielemans Douglas Luiz midfield, which is going to get walked through for the next few games, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Or they bring in Irog Bunim, maybe. Yeah. The who's a really good young midfielder, but he is a young midfielder. Like, he's a largely untried youngster. So it's going to be tough for them, and I'm thrilled about that.
Tielemans is rubbish. Like, I can't... He's only 26, but he moves like a 50-year-old. I just...
Oh, he's like...
It's unbelievable.
He's 34 in football years.
For sure. Because I remember when we played against Anderlecht way, way, way back in the day in Europa League, and he played against us. That's how long he's been around, since like AVB days. It's unbelievable how much football he's played. And I can't believe he's only 26 because, yeah, his legs are in bits.
Moussa Dembélé scores an incredible goal in that game. Yeah, do you remember being upset that Pochettino turned Tielemans down? He wouldn't have worked in that pressing system.
I still don't forgive Pochettino for not signing him. I still think he would have been a better option than
nothing.
Than like Weeks. Yeah, than Weeks Sissoko. But yeah.
Yeah, he's really not far from Winks in profile, I think, to be at the end of the day.
He's just totally fallen off a cliff. He used to be able to smack the ball and looked a bit interesting, but he's just stodged up and he's not good anymore. It's 30th of January 2011 and Spurs have just had one of their worst FA Cup exits at the hands of Saturday's opponents, Fulham. We had Michael Dawson sent off on 13 minutes, conceded two penalties and eventually lost 4-0. In our starting lineup that day were three players who have represented African international teams. Who were they?
2011.
I have no recollection. This is not, guess the game is not coming to me at all. And I remember that season well. Wait, what month did you say?
This was January 2011.
Okay, so a 10-11 season, not 11-12 season. Okay, so that's why. Okay.
Adebayor.
No. Two of them were defenders.
2011.
Two of them were defenders and one was a midfielder.
Bessong?
One was a... Bessong. Bessong. You've got one. Bessong was the centre-back.
Good work.
One was a midfielder and the other one was a left-footed defender.
Pienaar
was the midfielder.
A left-footed defender. I can't stop thinking of Atuba, but I think it's too late for him.
That's it's way too late for Atuba. Atuba was Atuba was like Martin Yol era.
Yeah, I'm just so bad at like my brain just cannot.
It was a left back.
Go back and like pick out different eras. Oh, Assou Ekotto.
Assou Ekotto. There we go. Ben White, Assou Ekotto, Sebastian Bessong.
Christ, made hard work of that.
Danny Murphy with two goals. Moussa Dembélé scored Fulham's fourth that day.
Pretty funny to get Bessong and not Assou Ekotto.
Yeah. I guess I think
if Ekotto was French.
I had off the back of these questions, I had quite an interesting conversation in the Discord, and I was very glad that I am not the only one who has a terrible. So my wife is constantly having to do my work for me in terms of like memory work, because I have the worst memory of anyone I know. I will go upstairs regularly and forget what I've gone upstairs for. I watch a football match and I will remember stuff about that match for like 3 or 4 days, and then it's just like filed away, gone forever. And like, if I don't talk about it and process it on this podcast on the Monday, if it was doing it in a week's time, I'd be fucked. This is why I have to write copious notes and running orders, because I just forget incidents that happen. My memory is shocking.
Sometimes when I'm researching for like a video or something, what I'll do is I'll go back and watch my own video on a topic to remember what I thought at the time. So I get it.
Yeah,
I want to give a little shout out to our ex-sub Josh Dean, who slid into my DMs after last week's quiz saying, I can't believe you forgot these two players. Completely oblivious that he got confused between Aston Villa and Fulham and started listing me Fulham players who had played for Tottenham. Yeah. I was like, thank you very much, mate. But no, you're incorrect.
I was worried I'd done that when I said Onoma. I was like, am I getting them mixed up? So I guess it's a thing.
Yeah.
He played for both. Yeah.
Life is about making correct decisions. For example, when Destiny flew past John McGinn, the correct decision was just to accept your toast, but he didn't. He doubled down and was found out. Bad decision making. Every day we go through a series of crossroads where we choose one route or another. Some are big, some are simple. Life is a complicated beast, so reduce some of your conundrums by getting your day started with the right decision. Scoop, drop, shake, and down your AG1 every morning. Be more Ange ball and less Villa kick, hoof, whack, dive ball. Build your day with solid foundations, solid principles, and front foot nutrition. AG1 is part of my routine, so no matter what my day throws at me, I've made the correct decision. Kick bad decisions into the McBin and start your day with AG1. Get it in you, mate.
If there's one product we had to recommend to elevate your health, it's AG1, and that's why we partnered with them for so long. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase exclusively at drinkag1.com/extra inch. That's drinkag1.com/extra inch. Check it out. So you're going to hear in a moment from Mem from Bees Pod, who has a campaign to tell you about. The reason this has come up is lots of Spurs fans live in and around the Barnet area and often follow Barnet as well. And there's some interesting stuff happening with Barnet at the moment. And Mem asked if they can get a message across to Extra Inch listeners. And in return, he's given us a little review of how Josh Keighley is getting on at Barnet as well. So you'll hear that now.
Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. My name is Mem, and I'm the co-host on Bees Pod, a Barnet podcast, and a member of the Bring Barnet Back campaign. To give you a short history, 10 years ago, after a lot of back and forth with the council, our chairman decided to move Barnet Football Club to our training ground in Canners Park in the borough of Harrow. Now we have a nice new shiny stadium called The Hive, but fans don't want to go to it. One of the reasons is that fans don't believe that Barnet should exist anywhere but Barnet. Another reason is that the transport links are terrible between Barnet and Cannons Park. So despite being only 7 miles away, it might as well be 107 miles. Now, luckily, the chairman has recognised this and an opportunity has arisen with a change in council, and Barnet are putting plans together for the land next to our spiritual home of Underhill for a new stadium. Now, the easy part is done. Barnet fans are all on board, but they don't make up all the residents of the area. We anticipate that a lot of Spurs fans do live in the area, and we need your support. Barnet returning will have a massive impact on the local community. An estimated £1 million worth of extra revenue will be generated for all the local businesses in the area from the return of the supporters. There'll be more local community projects linked to the club. There'll be facilities within the stadium that will benefit the community. And on days where Spurs are away, it's a local team to take your children. Now, there'll be a big planning process, and we anticipate there will be a lot of obstacles and hurdles to overcome. And we expect the council to put this to the residents. We want Tottenham fans to support our campaign to bring Barnet back. Traditionally, Tottenham fans have adopted Barnet as their second team. You'll often see Spurs shirts at Barnet games when Spurs are away. We are asking for you to support the Bring Barnet Back campaign. Display our posters in your window, which you can find at bringbarnetback.com. Register your support there. Follow Bring Barnet Back on Instagram. Follow at Bees Pod on Twitter for updates as well. And hopefully we can bring Barnet back to Barnet, where we belong. Thanks so much for your support. So let me tell you a little bit about how your goalkeeper Josh Keighley is doing at Barnet. So Josh came straight into the side when he arrived at Barnet. And since then, he's had some really, really good games. He's made a few errors, but on the whole, his handling is very clean, comes for crosses. He's a good shot stopper. He's great with his feet. He's very much a modern goalkeeper. Got a lot of confidence, cuts a lot of things out at source, which is something I've been quite impressed with. But he has, as what happens with a lot of young goalkeepers, made a couple of errors. But on the whole, I think it's been a really positive loan signing. And you can see why Spurs have got a lot of faith in this goalkeeper.
Nathan, Ange said some interesting stuff in the pre-Villa press conference about set pieces. I got into a debate, should we say, on the Discord about it. I love Ange. I think he is the best thing that's happened to Spurs in many, many years. I think he's wonderful. I love the style of football we're playing. I think he's a really decent bloke, like the most human manager we've had since God knows when. I also think he's a bit of a proper football man sometimes. And I think this is him being a proper football man about set pieces. And I do not understand his argument about not hiring a set piece coach at all. What do you think?
Suddenly I can't gather my thoughts together. I was initially...
Interesting chart for
yeah,
a start.
Yeah, I was initially quite frustrated by this. So much so that I slightly burnt my dinner because I was making a graph in the kitchen. Which I feel like is a very behind the curtain look into my personal life. Very telling.
That's the most Nathan thing I've ever heard.
I made a graph plotting expected goals created and conceded from set pieces, and then I highlighted the clubs who publicly hired a set piece specialist, right? Because what Postecoglou said was he doesn't really believe in bringing in a specialist, because he wants the way we approach our set pieces to be knitted into our overall play, and therefore it belongs to, in this case, Ryan Mason, who is our attacking focused coach, does our attacking set pieces, and Mila Jedinak, who's our defensive focused assistant coach, takes our defensive set pieces. And that irked me, because like, they are kind of their own thing, set pieces, and it's like, if you want to take your attacking mentality towards your set pieces, then when you hire your set piece coach, you can say, hey, look, please feel free to leave only two players outside the box or whatever, because we're a really attacking team. And you can say to your set piece coach, hey, at defensive set pieces, we want to be keeping in mind the counterattack. So if you want to keep two players away from other, you know, things like that, if you want to have a player wide on the halfway line when we're defending a corner, go ahead and do that. I don't mind. In reality, we actually do the opposite and we defend with all 11 players on our corners. I don't know, because I'm kind of a little bit sympathetic to his overall position of like keeping everything synergized, right? But I also think you can achieve that with a set piece specialist in your club and talking to them. I made this graph highlighting the teams who do publicly hire a set piece coach/analyst. And the trend is not perfect, right? It's not the case that all the teams in the top right hire a set piece coach. It's not the case that all the teams in the bottom left don't. But there's a strong trend. It's also, I think I probably said, I was probably wrong on Everton. Sean Dyche recently credited the analysts, plural, rather than the analyst, and I misread that. So he's referring to the general in-house analysts rather than a specific set piece analyst, right? And I think that's an important differentiation here. And then, yeah, maybe also at the same time, Liverpool don't currently have a set piece specialist, but they have done in the past, and they're obviously a very set piece focused team a lot of the time. So anyway, the trend isn't perfect, but it's there. And also the trend is probably more so the case for attacking set pieces, right? And if we think back to Vio, that makes sense, because he only did our attacking set pieces than defensive ones. Not only because sometimes you have a coach who only does the attacking end of set pieces and does the defensive ones, but also because, in my opinion, and I think that this bears in the stats, I think this especially bears in Aston Villa stats, a good attacking play, a good attacking set play, can get a man free with even the ball at his feet. Whereas defensively, you need some players who can jump in the air and hit the ball with their head. And I am reluctant to pile in on Mila Jedinak, just as I'm reluctant to pile in on Aston Villa's set piece coach, because I think in the game we just saw, you got two teams who aren't great in the air on an individual level. And I think that's very relevant to discussing our set pieces. So I don't want to be like, get rid of this, you know, magnificently bearded Australian bloke because he can't coach a defensive set piece. We've just changed how we defended them in this game. We are now protecting Vicario by pushing everyone north of the edge of the 6-yard box, so that in the second phase, anyone on the keeper is offside, which I think is bold, but I get it. Mm-hmm. We conceded a pretty significant chance off Zaniolo being 2v1 against Udogi at the back post. I don't know how or why we arrived at that situation, and arriving to a loose ball because Udogi stepped up to mark his other player. So still a work in progress, but at least there is some work in progress. I don't know. I think it's tricky because it's like, I'm worried I'm working too much backwards from the results. It's like, you know, again, Liverpool, they have an assistant coach who focuses on set pieces. Like, one of his jobs is set pieces. There's no reason why we, or it couldn't feasibly be achieved, that general first team coaches are very good at attacking or defending or both set pieces. So I understand that being something that you might want to aspire to, but the trends would suggest that the most successful teams at set pieces have someone who just does that.
Yeah, this is where I am. I think, so what we haven't said explicitly is that when looking at the data of expected goals scored, sorry, not scored, expected created. Goals per... expected goals created. Thank you, Nathan. We're looking at the trend of expected goals created per set piece. Spurs are fourth worst in the Premier League.
Yes.
And when looking at the data for expected goals conceded per set piece, Spurs are also fourth worst in the Premier League. So these are not good places to be for a club with infinite resources compared with the majority of a league. And I think on the attacking set piece front, there's a couple of things to note. Firstly, perhaps there's an element of trainer.
Yes.
So Vio comes in for a season. There's an expectation that he tells everyone at the club everything he knows about set pieces. Maybe he takes Ryan Mason under his wing and says, right, my protege, off you go, fly, go and make pretty set pieces happen. Also, we lost Harry Kane. Turns out Harry Kane's quite good at scoring from corners and free kicks defending. And extremely good at defending the near post as well. I would say, though, that we've got better players in terms of our delivery now in Porro and Maddison. And also, Richarlison is extremely good as a front post screen from defensive set pieces. So I'm not sure I buy the kind of Kane and Dyer are gone, we can't do set pieces anymore argument. I think there's a bit of a weakening there, but there's strengthening in other areas, i.e. the ability to take a really well-crafted set piece. I think it's a mistake. I think these are points we're leaving on the table because we're not hiring a set piece coach. I understand the idea that to focus on set pieces in training, you're giving up something else. There's only a certain amount of time on the training field.
Once a week.
I think it's worth it. I think this is foolish and a shame and a missed opportunity. And I do think it's kind of not getting with the times. Like, everyone's doing it. Like, they're doing it for a reason. There's points to be won here. There's goals to be scored. There's goals to be saved. And I think it's a pity, but something to keep an eye on for sure.
So we're the fourth worst at conceding chances from set pieces and the fourth worst at creating chances. That does need to be improved. If you look at how Man City are scoring goals and Arsenal are scoring goals in difficult situations just by taking advantage of set pieces, there's definitely 5, 6, 9 points maybe more available per season just there. So yeah, maybe sometimes we forget that Ange is a bit of a boomer because he is pretty old. So maybe he does need to change in that regard.
I really do think like with his the way he talks about young players, I think is quite old fashioned, and the way he talks about set pieces, I think also is quite old fashioned. That's not to say he's not modern in other ways, because he clearly is.
He's some way ahead of the curve on most issues, in my opinion.
Yeah,
Yeah, I mean, as much as I keep banging on about like a winger who can dribble past their man to unlock a low block, scoring off a corner will also make the opposition have to come out. The thing is that we talked about this for years before Vio came in, right? Maybe you get 9 points directly. And I think that was true last season, right? Games where we won the game on a set piece goal, that was what took us from 1-0 to 2-1 or whatever several times last season. Whereas this season, if we can get to 1-0 in the first half, and the opposition has to try and come out at us in the first half, that gives us a lot more game time to put 4 or 5 goals past them, right?
How many times have we seen Arsenal do that this season?
Yeah. They're not great at 0-0, in my opinion.
Yeah, breaking the deadlock is massive for them. We have another update on Lucas Bergvall. Thank you so much to Peter Strom. Before I read Peter's update, though, which I think is already one game out of date, by the way, Eric S. said, one really easy way to pronounce Lucas Bergvall's current club is Hugh Gordon.
I'm staying quiet this time.
Buddy, apparently you were even worse than me with your pronunciation.
I saw you thrashing about in the water, and I thought I'd jump in to try and save you and rescue you, and all I did was drown myself. So, be careful, people.
So, Peter says, a win in the third game of the Cup versus IFK Gothenburg and Ugedan are through to the next round. This game was a lot tougher when they played a team from the same division. The scoreline proves otherwise, 3-0, but they scored 2 with 11 versus 10 in the end. Big mistake by the goalkeeper for Ugedan's third goal. You could see what Gothenburg were trying to do, nullifying the impact of Bergvall, always putting one man and sometimes two on him. He used his understanding of the game and tried to pull out from his usual positions on the pitch to make it easier for his teammates to find him. In the second half, they subbed in Al Albin Ekdal with 70 odd caps for Sweden, and that made it more difficult for Gothenburg to keep hold of Bergvall. The first goal was obviously assisted by our kid. On the whole, less influence on the game, but still managed to do well. Okay, cool. We're going to wrap it up there because we want to talk season tickets, but this is a long pod. It's running long already. And so we feel like we need to do the season ticket discussion separately. And so we will release that later in the week.
You have been listening to The Extra Inch with me, Windy, my sidekick and best friend, Barney, and our tactics guy, Nate Clark. If you like this, there's plenty more at patreon.com/The Extra Inch. Production is by Nathan A. Clark. Our logo, artwork and website are designed by Creighton Miller. Our music is by David Lindmer. You can find him on Instagram at David Lindmer. Do check him out. He's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us at podcast@theextrainch.co.uk. Subscribe, leave us a rating and a review. And most importantly, be sure to tell all of your Spurs friends. Shout out to the X-Subs. We love every single last one of you. And of course, come on you Spurs. Thank you.